Well, friends, I think you'd agree with me that we live in troubling times. Over recent weeks, we've been only too aware of the menacing threat of terrorism, a threat not just way over there in the Arab world, but a threat that extends all the way back here to Australia. So we've seen homes and shops raided in Brisbane and in Sydney. We've seen at least one person charged with terrorism-related offences. We've seen police officers stabbed and their attacker killed. And each night on the news, we're reminded of the tragic human cost of the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa and the risk of the epidemic spreading. And we're aware of the tension between the Ukraine and Russia and the potential for that to spread into all-out war with all the associated human misery. So, friends, these are troubling times, but not only are they troubling, they're actually very perplexing. So our government is introducing laws which may infringe on our freedoms in order to keep us all safe. So on the one hand, to take away people's freedoms is bad, but to protect the community and keep us safe is good. So the question is what the government is doing bad, or is it good? It's actually a bit perplexing to really know. And also Western allies who condemn Assad in Syria as a war criminal now find themselves cooperating with his supporters against a greater enemy in ISIS. Friends, it's complicated and perplexing to think about these things. In fact, life in this troubled world is complicated and is perplexing. And it has been ever since the first human rebellion in the Garden of Eden. So how should we think about this perplexing life in this troubled world? Well, one approach is absurdism, you know, to shrug our shoulders and say, it's not my problem, it doesn't affect me, she'll be right, mate. And so change the channels and watch a good movie, or have another beer or three. It's to say, I don't care, like Bob Geldof sang in The Great Song of Indifference. I don't mind if culture crumbles, I don't mind if religion stumbles, I can't hear the speakers mumble, and I don't care at all. I don't care if the third world fries, it's hotter there, I'm not surprised. Baby, I can watch whole nations die, and I don't care at all. That's absurdism. Or another approach to the perplexity in this troubled world is to get overwhelmed with anxiety and depression, and many people do. A bit like the band America sang. Well, I tried to make it Sunday, but I got so damn depressed that I set my sights on Monday and I got myself undressed. You know, it's all too hard, it's too depressing, can't face the world and its problems, so I'll put my PJs on and go back to bed, maybe for good. And a third approach is the Pollyanna approach. You know, a zippity-doo-dah approach. My, oh my, what a wonderful day. You know, to pretend that everything's fine and dandy in the garden. That the world and its problems are really just make-believe. And that's basically the approach of Hinduism and Buddhism. So, friends, life under the sun is perplexing, and the question is, how should we react to this troubling perplexity? Should we take the absurdist approach? Life makes no sense at all, so let's crack a can and forget about it. Or should we retreat into hopeless depression? Or, like Pollyanna, play make-believe and ignore life's harsh realities? And friends, this is where Ecclesiastes 7 to 10 helps us. The preacher in Ecclesiastes wouldn't have us ignore life's perplexities. He would encourage us to think seriously about life and all its perplexity. Friends, the preacher here, as we've seen before, writes from the perspective of life under the sun, life as we experience it in the here and now. though he believes in God, he's not actually completely certain about what happens after death. So he's concerned that we live life wisely because we only get one shot. And friends, what else would motivate us to think about life wisely? Well, death. So when my mum died 20 years ago, I was confronted with hard reality, as many of you have been as well. There's nothing quite like looking into the grave of a loved one to make you realise life's not a joke. It's not a game. It will end one day, and perhaps sooner than we think. So we'd better start thinking about life wisely, about how to wisely use the life we've been given. In that sense, it's like chapter 7, verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. So it's good to think seriously about life. And friends, what are the things that we find perplexing in life? What curveballs does life throw at us? Well, for one thing, there's life's injustices. You see, life is actually full of injustice. So there's the injustice of not receiving the acknowledgement you deserve, of seeing someone else take the credit for what you've done. Perhaps at work, you know, you've put in all the effort, but then your supervisor takes all the credit in front of the business owner. Or perhaps on the footy field, you've done all the hard things all day, what Tommy Hafey would have called chasing and tackling and harassing, but the accolades go to the full forward who's kicked a bag of goals simply because he's been spoon-fed the ball all day. Or more significantly, the story of some Vietnam veterans returning to Australia in 1972 who were treated with hostility. They were sent by Australia to do a job, many of them conscripts, but they received no thanks for doing it. So it's a bit like the poor wise man in chapter 9 who, after having saved the city, was promptly forgotten. Look at 9 verse 14. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. That poor man, that poor wise man saved the city, but afterwards no one remembered him. What an injustice. You see, life's injustices are things that actually really get us in the guts, don't they? When we see injustice and when we hear of injustice, it affects us. It appalls us. And the greater the injustice, the more we're appalled. Injustice makes us cry out, "This is wrong, this should not be." So some of you will remember the shocking case of 2-year-old James Bulger. He was abducted from an English shopping centre and murdered in 1993. And there was actual video footage of the two young killers leading James away by the hand. And when I saw that on TV, it affected me. It was shocking and wrong and evil, especially because the young killers were later released from prison after serving only 8 years. Friends, it appalls us to see injustice, and especially when perpetrators get away with it. And it appalls the preacher too. He's seen a good man's life cut short while an evil man lives long in his evil. to keep doing evil. In fact, it may be that even by his evil that he prolongs his life. And years ago, Billy Joel sang the song, "Only the Good Die Young." Therefore, according to Billy Joel, there's no point being good, and maybe the preacher would have agreed with him. And it is very confronting when good people die young, doing good work, when they die young. So, for example, an example of this confronting nature of those good people who die young was the case of Graham Staines. He was an Australian missionary. He was caring spiritually and physically for those with leprosy in rural India. He was telling them about Jesus and treating their leprosy. Yet one terrible night, Graham was burnt to death by Hindu extremists with his two young sons. A horrendous, unjust death, leaving a wife and daughter behind. A good man killed young. Unlike, for example, the tyrant Idi Amin. Idi Amin brutalized the people of Uganda during the 1970s. He lived a long life in exile in Saudi Arabia, eventually dying as an old man. Idi Amin, a murderous thug, never called to account, never facing justice under the sun. Friends, the preacher would like to think that the good, that good people are rewarded in this life and that evildoers are punished. But to his great dismay, he sees the opposite. To his great dismay, he sees the opposite. So look at chapter 8, verse 14. "There is a vanity that takes place on earth. There are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this is also a vanity." The righteous getting what the wicked deserve, and the wicked getting what the righteous deserve. A great injustice on the earth under the sun. But the preacher can't even console himself with the thought that this injustice will be reversed after death, because he's vague and uncertain about the possibility of an afterlife. He just sees that those who do good and evildoers have the same destiny, the grave. So look at chapter 9, verse 2. "It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he who swears an oath is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead." Under the sun, he observes the righteous and the wicked have precisely the same destiny, the grave, and to him, it's a great evil. And friends, not only is life unjust, that is, that those who perpetrate evil seem to get away with it, and sometimes those who perpetrate evil, like Idi Amin, die at a ripe old age, and those who do good, who sacrificially do good, like Graham Staines, get cut off in their prime. But life's full of randomness. Life's perplexing not just because of the injustices we see, but there's also randomness to life under the sun. Friends, sometimes there just seems to be no rhyme or reason to why things happen. And the preacher knows about this randomness. So look at chapter 9, verse 11. "Again I saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favour to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all." So, for example, this week, Matt Pridis won the Brownlow Medal an outsider, and apparently no one was more surprised than him. Or remember Steve Bradbury, the Australian speed skater? He won gold in the 2002 Winter Olympics when everyone else in the race crashed and fell over. In Bradbury's case, the race definitely was not to the swift, but to the surprised. But at a more serious level, life contains other randomness, like the tsunami on Boxing Day 2014, which killed 230,000 people. Just like that, they had no warning, under the sun, a random event. So poor fishermen and villagers were wiped out, and wealthy holiday makers were gone. Under the sun, a random, unprecedented tragedy. Like the tragic words we read in chapter 9, verse 12. For man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare. So the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Yes, life under the sun has its randomness, where bad or good things happen apparently by chance. Like a lottery, apparently, if your number's up, it's up. And this randomness, this apparent randomness, even affects politics. So in some unnamed countries, you can get less than 1% of the primary vote and end up in parliament. In that case, potentially any fool could end up in government, a bit like what happens in chapter 10, verse 5, where we read, "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves." So somehow here, fools end up in power, while the rich, who in the preacher's worldview would normally be wise, they're on the outer. Everything the opposite of how it should be. Everything upside down, like the land of topsy-turvy in the children's storybook, The Folk of the Faraway Tree. And when everything's upside down, when everything's topsy-turvy, people suffer. So when politicians behave childishly, or worse, when they behave like party animals, the country suffers, like we see in chapter 10, verse 16. "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness." So, friends, we've seen that injustice and randomness make life perplexing and troubling. And the preacher feels this. The tragedies, the injustices, the apparent randomness, he feels it. But the preacher doesn't shrink from life's troubling perplexity. He's not like the absurdist. He doesn't say, well, let's just have a party and forget about it. He doesn't withdraw from life in lonely depression. And he's not like Pollyanna. He doesn't pretend life's perfect. No, he reminds himself that despite appearances, God is in control. And here he's very consistent with the message of both the Old Testament and the New. The preacher understands, friends, that God is working in all the apparent randomness of life. So look at chapter 7, verse 13 to 14. According to the preacher, God is working. So we read, "Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him." Yes, the preacher is saying God is in control, even when we're not completely sure what he's up to. Like he says over in chapter 8, verse 17. "Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may seek a toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. God is working, even though we sometimes don't completely understand how. So because God is in control, the preacher recommends enjoying life if you can, to enjoy it as a gift from God. So if you look at 8 verse 15, we read, "And I commend joy, for man has no good thing under the sun, but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun." God is the one who's given us life under the sun, and we should enjoy this life where we can. And the same thought comes out strongly in chapter 9, verse 7. "Go, eat your bread in joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your life, of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun." Life is a gift, as we saw in chapter 8, verse 15, and life's simple pleasures also are God's gift, like pleasures like food and drink and festivities. So in those days, you'd dress yourself in white and you'd have oil on your head. Simple pleasures like companionship in marriage and friendship and our daily work, even with its inevitable frustrations. So the preacher implores people to energetically embrace life. As we read in 9 verse 10, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going." And the same idea is found over in chapter 2, verse 24 to 25. There we read, "There is nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment?" And part of enjoying this life under the sun is being content with God's provision for us and content with our situation. Don't know about you, but I wonder whether you've ever found yourself reminiscing about the good old days, however you might define them, and whether you were there or not. You know, maybe when life was simpler or slower. And it is pretty easy to romanticize the past, don't you think? Perhaps especially when we find ourselves in uncertain, perplexing times in the present. So sometimes I reminisce to Julie about the good old days when we live in Shepparton. We have many wonderful memories, but as Julie reminds me, there were difficulties in Shepparton as well. So for me to get too nostalgic about the good old days in Shep is just not wise. A bit like we read in chapter 7, verse 10. "Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this." Friends, God, who's in charge of life, is pleased for us to enjoy life, including right here and now, where he's placed us, instead of always yearning for the good old days. Well, friends, we've seen that life is perplexing and it's often troubling. Life has many injustices and tragedies which occur seemingly randomly. And friends, we can't just gloss over them and pretend they don't exist. And usually we can't fix them, whether they're intractable wars in the Middle East or sadnesses in the lives of friend and family. And yet we've also seen that life is definitely a gift from God. The God who's in control of the whole of life, which to us sometimes seems out of control. And we've seen that it's good and right to enjoy life, this gift from God, when we can. Friends, the preacher recommends enjoyment of life under the sun, not only because it's a gift from God, but also, frankly, because he's not certain what happens afterwards. He's not certain about life after death. The preacher seems to adopt the old adage, "You're a long time dead." But friends, we're greatly privileged compared to the preacher. We're privileged because of Jesus. Jesus himself powerfully addresses the issue of whether or not there's life after death. So in John 11, verse 25, Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." And then Jesus brought back to life his dead friend Lazarus. And not only that, but Jesus himself, after dying on the cross, was raised to life again. And now Jesus lives forever and ever at the right hand of God the Father. So Jesus demonstrates that there is more than life under the sun. Jesus knows that there's life after death, and he's proved that there is life after death. So therefore, friends, we need not be like the preacher. We can be certain of life after death because of Jesus. And this resurrected Jesus, friends, understands life in all its perplexities and troubles. You see, Jesus himself experienced life's pains and sorrows. He experienced the ultimate pain and sorrow of giving his life's blood to pay for our sin. Jesus cares so much for people that he died for the sins of all who trust in him. And this Jesus cares for all who are weighed down by life's troubling perplexities, by life's burdens. And we see that in Matthew 11, verse 28. Jesus says, "Come to me, all who labour and are heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Friends, Jesus can and will give rest to every burdened person who turns to him. So friends, is life perplexing for you? Are you troubled by life, perhaps especially in these days? Do the injustices and the seemingly random tragedies of life make you anxious? Well, if that's the case, welcome to the club. You're not on your own. Friends, the preacher in Ecclesiastes had good advice. Enjoy life if you can, as a gift from God, despite life's perplexities. But now, because of Jesus, we can do even better. We can trust in Jesus, the one who's conquered death and who now lives forever and ever. He's the one who gives us hope amidst life's difficulties and who invites us to bring our burdens to him. He's the one who gives eternal rest to all who come to him in dependent trust. If we're trusting in Jesus for forgiveness of our sins, it's our privilege to also trust him for strength and perseverance in life's difficulties. But friend, if you're not yet trusting in Jesus' death for your sin, if you're not yet a Christian, then today's a great day to start. Today would be a great day to confess your sin to God, to turn away from ignoring him, and to trust in Jesus. And if you do that, friend, Jesus will not only forgive you and grant you eternal life, eternal rest, but he'll also be right there with you by his Spirit today and every day, giving you strength to face life under the sun, no matter what comes.